Members, I'd like to get started. We're having trouble with our audio visuals, so I guess we're going to see those another day. This is the second time that's happened, so I'm hoping we can get those officially checked out and see what the issues are with those. And I want to call the meeting to order. We have House File 1188 with Representative Winkler first on the agenda. And welcome to the committee. If you would like to, we're here for an informational hearing, is that right, Representative Winkler? Okay. If you'd like to tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for having me back. New faces, I guess, but some reliable. House File 1188 is basically a bill, a version of the Growth and Justice Smart Investments in Minnesota Students Report. The premise of the, and Angie Eilers is here from Growth and Justice, she'll go through it, but the highlight really is that this the goal is to align our education system from birth through 16 and beyond, actually, around a particular measure, a particular goal that is economically relevant and important for our state, namely to increase the number of people by 50% who receive some kind of post-high school degree. And Angie can talk about this more in detail, but what this bottom line is that we need more well-educated people because for demographic and economic reasons. This bill helps to realign existing resources towards that goal, as well as anticipates additional revenue in the amount of $1 billion a year going for the entire education system, again, from birth through college. So rather than focusing on one particular area, whether it's K-12 or early childhood or higher ed, it's a recognition that all of these are vitally important, and that as we spend money, we should be spending money based on research and evidence of what works well, so that we are moving towards a goal that is a public policy imperative for the state and something that is quantifiable and measurable that the public can get behind and know that we are pursuing. So with that, I would actually turn it over to Angie to review the report.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Angie Eilers. I'm the Research and Policy Director at Growth and Justice. And for those of you who have heard this a few times, my apologies. It's nice to be before this committee, and I look forward to any questions. But as Representative Winkler spelled out, we are taking the long-term view here about advancing our students' opportunities to be a part of, contribute to, and benefit from a growing economy, a larger, more prosperous economy. And we do that by setting a long-term goal that by 2020 we'd like to see a 50% increase in the number of students who have a post-secondary degree. And that is because something beyond high school will set students apart from a living wage and a non-living wage, a one-year or a two-year or a four-year degree. And as many of you strategically know, starting early is the best way to reach that goal in the most cost-effective way. Invest early and realize the long-term gains in the long run. I'll direct you to the paper handout, if you don't mind. The audio visuals didn't work as well, but it's this PowerPoint. On slide 3 is a pie chart that spells out the number of students who currently hold either a two-year or a four-year degree, about 52% of Minnesota students in the age cohort of 25 to 34. That's 1 in 2. We'd like it to look more like 3 out of 4 students, whereby 75% of students have a post-secondary degree by the year 2020. But our state's demographer projects that if we do nothing between now and the year 2020, that combined rate of two-year and four-year degree holders will actually shrink back to about 38%. So our opportunity is truly now to start investing so that we can reach that 2020 goal. And you can see from the demographic breakout by race and ethnicity that the state's demographer has put out that it's the population that has been attaining the post-high school degrees the fastest, that is the slowest growing population. So our white population is growing at 7% between now and the year 2030, whereas a number of other subpopulations are growing at a much faster rate, and we need to educate all of our students and as soon as possible. The following bar graph makes that case perhaps a little more sharply. That is to translate by year 2020 in order to get a 50% attainment rate, given our race and ethnicity changes, we will need something more like 243 students for every 100 Latino students who are graduating today, for a total of 343 to 375 Latino students by 2020. Or for every 100 African Americans who finish a post-secondary degree today, we'll need an additional 150 for a combined rate of 250 African American students. So you can see that we've got room to grow. I don't see this as much as a challenge as it is an opportunity to invest well in all of our students. And of course, we don't choose our children. We argue investing in all of our children from birth to college. I know it would be very tempting this legislative session to choose among our children, to invest in one end of the education continuum or the other, but we're arguing that we wouldn't forsake any of them and that they all deserve our investments from birth to college.
Ms. Eilers, I hope you did notice we said zero for cuts from birth through college. So that paralleled your proposal.
Yes, I'm pleased to know that, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
In this chart with the colored benchmarks, the shaded benchmarks at third, eighth, and high school are statutory requirements that by the year 2013-2014, and this reflects the No Child Left Behind Act that has been adopted in state statute, we will have to get all of our students reading at the third grade level, taking and passing Algebra 1 by the end of eighth grade, and taking and passing advanced science courses in Algebra 2. I'll focus on the early childhood for your purposes here. While the ready for K is not mandated or in statute, I think we all know through cognitive science and now more and more through conventional wisdom that the more students we have ready for kindergarten, the more we'll be reading by the end of the third grade. And also, the more students are ready for kindergarten, the less we'll have to be spending in remediation in the years K through 3. Nonetheless, we would argue that investing in children from birth to third grade at about $400 million would set us on the road of having all of our children reading at a high comprehension level, which will ready them for taking advanced math courses. And in the long term, we will have spent that $400 million very well. If by not having children reading at the third grade level, they are frequently labeled as learning disabled by the fourth grade, and the cost of educating them on their reading skills goes up by a factor of four. So we would argue that the $200 to $400 million invested early to get more and more students reading by the end of third grade over the long term is a savings of a factor of 4 to 1. I don't want to take up your time right now to talk about percentages of students who are not on track. I think many of us know that. You've heard many testimonies this session about the number of students who we are worried about, but needless to say, there are these benchmarks to meet. There are a number of students who are not currently there. We are coming up against a lot of different local, state, and global pressures to get our kids more and more educated and educated well, and we know how much room there is to go. So with that, what we've taken the time to do is to look at all of the literature that points to the interventions that are going to make a difference for these kids, to move the needle, if you will, from those students who are off track or currently perform below proficiency levels and moving them back on track that's going to correlate with their later and likely success in high school and post-secondary education. And on table, or at slide 10, we spell those out, those things which have been shown to have an effect, but we put ourselves through a stricter filter, if you will, by asking about those programs that are also very cost-effective. We have the assistance of seven nationally preeminent scholars and economists on these topics who helped us sort out the vast body of literature on what's going on with children and in schools, but we ask what works and at what cost. And this is a menu of options that we'd like to think that school districts in the state have to work from when we consider investing our next dollar. And I think for your committee's purposes, the first left hand of that chart is notable. There are on the following slide a number of other promising interventions. What those represent are either that they've shown to be effective, but we don't have a cost analysis done on them yet, or that they are in the middle of their evaluation period and are showing early indicators of being a promising and an effective practice, but they're still under review. And then in the slide 12, again, for your purposes, the interventions that we would call for range from increasing access to prenatal care. Minnesota ranks 27th right now in the nation, which is an unfortunate ranking. Expanding subsidies for access to quality child care, and implementing parent mentoring home visiting programs, particularly for families low income and at risk, and providing at least a half day of four-year-old preschool, and ideally from the ages of pre-K 4 or kindergarten to third grade, reducing class size 15 to 1, coupled with intensive instructional focus on reading skills, language acquisition skills, and developing home-school child relationships between the home and the school, all for a total of about $405 million of the billion-dollar investment that we think should be made in our educational system. I won't go through the other spreadsheets at this time unless there are questions, but let me just close with the very final slide, number 16, and that is to point out that if nothing else, we would like to this body to contemplate four principles, no matter what bill eventually comes out of this committee or the House, and that is to commit to investing in the entire education continuum from birth to college and not making choices among our children, to invest very comprehensively in our students and children from the academic and the social and the financial perspective, to make investments that are known to be effective based on the research and meeting students' needs where they're at, and showing accountability for those by investing in those things that are shown to be cost-effective. And with that, Madam Chair, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Representative Winkler, did we tell you when you come back to the committee you were supposed to bring treats?
Madam Chair, I don't always listen to what I'm
okay. Well, next time.
Mediation.
Any further comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just would like to just briefly state that the bill, House File 1188, really anticipates a process and a mechanism for beginning to assess what we do, how these proven cost-effective strategies could be implemented into what we already have, and to come back in a year with a series of reforms that both look at what we have and anticipate how another $1 billion a year in total funding across this entire spectrum could be used. And so for that, we create basically an oversight advisory committee that would have broad representation from kind of a high level, the legislature, the executive, and then a series of subcommittees to look at each of the policy areas. I guess in this case, one of them would be birth to third grade. So looking at that entire system. The advantage is that it's not limited by legislative committees or by agencies or by existing funds or programs, but it's looking at the years of the child and trying to look at then what programs we have in place and what might need to be changed. The idea is then they come back with a set of recommendations that would then be available for us to fund and move things around. So that's the idea, is to have a comprehensive look at the entire education system and realign as necessary towards this goal of putting research-based programs together and expanding current programs according to research, and then move it towards a specific outcome, which is the attainment rate that Angie was talking about.
Okay, we do have some questions. Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, on the prenatal age for the nurse home visiting, would that be mandatory, voluntary, or who would determine when that was necessary?
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, I think Angie needs to respond to that, but it's my understanding that typically mandatory home visiting programs are not favored, and voluntary works much better, although you have to fund, I think, effective outreach to make sure that you're getting participation that you're looking for.
Ms. Eiler?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's certainly involuntary and in a targeted way. It would not be universal. This would be for families who have not been benefiting from or accessing other programs like early childhood family education, but rather would be receiving the benefits of an at-home visit for either a public health nurse or social worker licensed provider to their home.
Thanks.
Well, Representative Downey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about the maybe the wisdom of building into this the assumption of $1 billion of additional education funding. I hear talk that our next forecast may not actually even be as promising as the ones we're budgeting around now. And given what's going on nationally, that's maybe a reasonable assumption. is this thing dependent on the $1 billion, or can the framework of prioritization and prior of areas actually be built irrespective of the dollar amount being there?
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I think in part, yes, it can be done without that, because what you're, I mean, the framework that you're talking, that we're talking about is a way of looking at the issue. It's a way of analyzing existing programs. So, of course, you could, I suppose, optimize what we have along these principles. I think you were in K-12 finance. This idea of $1 billion in additional education funding is part of the larger growth and justice framework, which is, I think sets the goal of 17% as the total price of government in Minnesota, which is actually kind of an average number over the last, well, since that mechanism or that measurement was first put in place. And at $2 billion a year total of new spending by state government, half of that would be in the total education system. So that's where that number comes from. Of course, we're in an extraordinary economic situation right now, and so the idea is, let's not base this entirely on the unusual times that we're in, but let's think about what this may look like in more typical economic times, even if it will take us some time to pull forward.
Ms. Eilers, if I could respond, Madam Chair, Representative. This would be a mechanism, as Representative Winkler said, that is in place in the event that we have new money coming through, and it would be a way of testing against a number of key principles about whether the next dollar is spent in the best way. So, for example, we do have this federal stimulus money coming that we had not anticipated, and I think we are at a moment where we're sort of struggling with where and how much to spend and to what effect, and how will we know whether these dollars are going to have their intended effect. If this sort of framework were used as a filter for an advisory committee, that $1 billion that we may, up to $1 billion that we're seeing through the federal government would have a filter to go through as a kind of test, so that we can say to the taxpayer and back to the federal government, we did well by these dollars. It went into programs that we know that are known to be effective.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I know I've talked to parents in your community that strongly support the new Minnesota Miracle, and this is a piece that fits nicely with the innovation revenue portion of that. I know you don't serve on K-12, but if you have a chance to look over that proposal, which is looking toward the future, and it's also a way to stimulate the economy and get us back to being a productive state, sticking out like the state of Minnesota used to do, and now we're sticking out worse than other states. So we need to get back to education, and I think the sooner we get going on that, the better off we are. And having that money be used for things that would actually work is, I think, a great service with this bill that Representative Winkler and Growth and Justice have put forward. And I would just say a word, as long as I'm on that topic, Madam Chair, that because of the budget deficit, we're going to have to look to the future as we're implementing that, and I want to put it into statute and get it there as a beacon for us to move towards. And we absolutely need to get the early childhood portion of the vision attached on that, because Growth and Justice has pointed out very clearly here that there aren't bright lines between early childhood and K-12, and so we have to have the whole continuum so that we can have students graduating ready for success. And a big part of that, with what works with smart investments, is early childhood. So I hope that we can get that vision in place as soon as possible. I know that that early childhood started later than K-12. We had the benefit of the governor's proposal and the PS Minnesota. But hopefully we can get that in there as soon as possible, because we all know that it takes a long time around here for people to get used to what we're going to do before we finally get around and do it. And so we need this before us as well.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. We are working on, maybe we'll call it the Little Minnesota Miracle, the younger Minnesota Miracle too. But as far as the early childhood part of that, just so everybody knows, we'll most likely after bill deadlines, we will have that come out. And we're hoping that those of you in the audience will thoroughly vet that this summer and fall, and we can get that in the shape that we need it to be, so we also have the vision at the early childhood level. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wicker, thank you for bringing this forward. I was glad to sign on as a co-author of this. Ms. Eilers, as you know, I have reviewed this frequently, and strongly support it, and am appreciative of the fact that you're going to do a presentation up in my district coming up here.
Mm-hmm.
But let me, you know, so you have, and it ties so nicely with House File 2 of Minnesota Miracle. I just think the both of them work together, as Representative Winkler said and Representative Guiling said, and then with the younger Minnesota Miracle, or the next phase that we add to that, it's just a vision for the future that's exciting for all of us with our children. Let me ask you this. Have you, outside of us here, who kind of live in a shell, in a tunnel for about 5 months, have you gotten any feedback from other education folks or parents or the public in general on this?
Ms. Eilers? Madam Chair, Representative Ward, thank you for the question. I have actually been to the four corners of the state and I've spoken to over 1,200 Minnesotans since October. Parents groups, superintendent groups, all sorts of school groups, groups that are interested in the economy, citizens and taxpayers, and I would say to a number, I can maybe count on one hand among the 1,200 where I've gotten any dissonance, resonates. Well, it resonates loudly. There is an appetite, there's an interest, there's an eagerness to embrace ideas that are known to work, ideas that they know, that Minnesotans know we can afford, and ideas that they recognize we can't afford not to address. So there's an eagerness. Just today I was at a lunchtime group, and one of the gentlemen said, "Have you been on Almanac? Why aren't you on Almanac? This really needs to be discussed more publicly," and we're all interested in seeing that these things are funded, and there's a willingness in Minnesota to invest in education, particularly around those things that they have the confidence to say our tax dollars are being spent well.
Representative Ward.
Thank you for a follow-up. And this is based on research that Growth and Justice has done over a what number of period of years, and how was that funded, that research project?
Ms. Eilers. Representative Ward, Madam Chair, thank you for asking the question. First study that we did was in 2006 to first assess the appetite for whether Minnesotans are willing to invest more in their state. And 70% of Minnesotans said certainly willing to invest and willing to pay for it, there was a high response rate to what we posed as the penny on the dollar question. A penny on the dollar meaning you'd be willing to pay 1 cent more on the dollar in your income taxes to invest in what we know in Minnesota works. Investing in Minnesota's people and places. And of the 70% response rate, of those who said yes, the interest was in investing in education first and foremost, transportation, and health tied for second. So we've developed an investment proposal that is investing in Minnesota's people and places, and the education research has been underway since 2007. First vetted through national scholars and economists, and then nationally, or statewide, vetted through a 25-member steering committee who represented all stakes in this topic, from the business community, the parent community, and from early childhood to higher ed. And it's also benefited from the advice of a number of scholars from the University of Minnesota. So I would say that it's been publicly and from scholars heavily vetted, and has been modified according to feedback and is resonating well with the larger public.
Great, thank you. You think of Representative Downey and then Representative Mack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just make a comment, and if you'd like to respond again, I guess you can. The framework, as I understand it in the presentation, in my mind really presumes this additional $1 billion. I mean, all of your kind of categories and subcategories have a dollar amount attached to them, and they add up to this $1 billion of new investment. And I actually really support this kind of an E to 16 perspective. We do have overlap between the early and K-12 system. We have, I think, an increasing overlap. Probably an extremely inefficient and costly one at the higher ends of the K-12 system and the higher ed system. And so I think looking at it from this perspective makes a lot of sense to me. But I would want to make sure that we're applying that framework to all of the billions of dollars that we're spending on education statewide, and not simply the next billion, if I'm making sense. And I think I'm inferring from your answer that this would be a broader framework that would allow us to do that. But if not, I think that would if people answering that same question knew that we weren't applying the same kind of thinking to the entire spectrum of all of the spending going on today, I'm not sure that they'd say spend the extra penny. They might say, let's go back and look at the first dollar we spent and make sure that it's being run through this exact same filter. So I'll leave it at that. If you want to comment, that's fine.
Madam Chair, I just would, my only response would be that this is not intended. It's just an add-on to the existing system. The idea is to look at what we're doing and making and seeing if we can reorganize and realign along these goals.
Representative Mayer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a technical question on in Section 1, where it talks about the makeup of the Oversight Advisory Committee, consisting of 12 members. I'm just curious, going forward in here, it says both from the Senate and from the House, there would be 3 from the majority and 1 from the minority. And I'm just curious, what's the rationale for that makeup versus going 50-50, you know, whoever in the majority and going forward, why you chose that makeup and not more of a 50-50?
Madam Chair, actually, in the policy committee, we amended the bill to say that it would be 2 and 2 instead of 3 and 1. At the Representative Abler offered that amendment, and we accepted it.
I have one quick follow-up question. I was trying to find it here, and so maybe I'm missing it. Is there a timeline as far as is the oversight committee reappointed every few years, or reevaluated, or how does that work? If somebody steps down, is it just the majority or minority leader reappoint someone to fill the vacancy, or is it reevaluated on a regular basis as far as the makeup?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, on line 2.29 and 2.30, it specifies that actually the Oversight Committee is sunsetted, so it wouldn't continue to exist absent ongoing legislative action.
Any other questions? I want to make one comment and ask you a question, and then we'll wrap up. Is Representative Downey, as to your question, it's unfortunate Representative Biskins isn't here, because kind of somewhat what you're talking about is sort of zero-based budgeting or prior priority budgeting. And we are moving towards that, and the Speaker is definitely trying to move all the committees towards what are the priorities in their committees. And I'm going to give one of our audience members a gold star today. With Mr. Johnson, who's presenting next, he did give me his priorities today of the department. It was a very well done, very thorough, understandable document that we can work on and try to figure out, frankly, where to cut is the real issue. But the idea is this year and next year, we're going to be making tremendous cuts. I mean, we do know that, but we also have to do some reinvesting and prioritizing. So with the help of the departments, and if we can work in conjunction, we can maybe state government has to become smaller, but it has to be strategically better. And I think that's what I see this bill being all about. My question to you would be, and I'm sure you've gotten this one before, about the swales bill and how is this different from kind of a T20 bill that she's doing, and can you tell us about that?
Madam Chair, this is sort of, I would say that this bill is more of an umbrella of a series of bills that kind of covers this. Representative Swales' P20 bill is basically putting in statute a group that already exists, which it performs kind of a research function. Their charter is not to go out and make kind of substantive suggestions on how to make major realignment of systems that we have today. So I think it incorporates the concept of the T16 partnership or council, but I think it expands their mission greatly. And there are a number of other bills that I know that Representative Mariani is considering for a policy omnibus bill to tie in with the innovation revenue with the House File 2. So I think this is part of that discussion. I think this has kind of covered a lot of the ground that a number of other bills try to reach, but the goal, the idea is to eventually kind of figure this out in his policy bill.
Any other questions? Any last comments?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. A very interesting bill. Thank you for presenting it to us. Thank you. Members, next thing we'll do is move the minutes. Anybody?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Hamilton, on the ball. We have 2 dates, March 12th and March 17th.
I've read them both, Madam Chair.
Okay, good.
I approve them.
Representative Hamilton moves the minutes for March 12th and 17th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are passed. Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure I was recorded as being here present.
Oh, I see. I think we got that one. Thank you. Next we have Mr. Johnson's going to do a presentation on the Department of Human Services Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations. So if you'd like to come forward and get started. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm not sure what documents you have in front of you. Do you have the revised budget pages? Should have.
Yes. People have their budget books. Do you have those pages? Okay. In the back? We need a minute for the members to get those. If you don't have your book, the pages can... Does everybody have that?
I'm sorry, I'm actually going to start with page 41 on the document that I have. It says 41 revised, so if you can find that, that's probably the most helpful thing.
Okay. Everybody have that? Okay, if you'd like to go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Chuck Johnson, Department of Human Services. I'm starting on page 41. There are three pages within this committee's jurisdiction where there have been changes made, page 41 being the first one. Madam Chair, this is the page that titled Best in Early Learning. You may recall this is a page where we were proposing to use... Madam Chair?
I don't have mine yet. But
okay.
Just, so I just have this blank. There we go. Okay. Go ahead.
This is the page we were proposing to use the expected underspending in the basic sliding fee program, which is Child Care Development Fund federal dollars, to continue two important initiatives, the Parent Aware rating system and the School Readiness Connections Child Care Assistance Initiative. What's updated here is basically when I presented this page the first time, we didn't have the actual underspending for basic sliding fee. This just updates the numbers. We now know there was $5.2 million underspent. That is enough to cover the two initiatives we're proposing, and as we proposed initially, this page then also would refinance the other $2.7 million of that CCDF underspending to help with the general fund deficit. So no change from a policy perspective there at all, just updating the numbers.
Okay.
And turn to the next page, is page 52.
Okay.
Page 52 is the Child Care Assistance Program reductions. You'll recall this page initially had a 3% reduction to the rates we pay providers in the Child Care Assistance Program, and a 3% increase in the co-pays that families pay in Child Care Assistance. On the original government's proposal, the effective date for these changes was July 1 of 09. We're proposing to delay the effective date on those changes to October 1 of 2010. We are using stimulus money to essentially help us fund the delay of those reductions over that time period.
Mr. Johnson, is it why you can't get through the whole biennium and just not do the cut?
Madam Chair, we could, although it would leave less the stimulus money to help with the other issue that I'm going to get to next, which is part of why we did it. The stimulus, CCF stimulus money runs through this time period. And also, we do believe we still need to have those program reductions on the table because even though stimulus money helps us for the one-time short-term, we still long-term have a deficit that we need to address.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the last page that I will talk about is page 60, which is labeled TANF refinancing. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about how we're using the stimulus, because some of that is located here. In particular for the child care stimulus money. The federal stimulus bill included child care development fund dollars in total of $26.1 million for Minnesota. $3.4 million of that is set aside for quality, and in a second I'll ask Deb Swenson-Clatt to address that part of our proposal. The remainder, which is about $22.6 million, we are proposing to use to offset the increase in the forecast for the MFIP transition year child care assistance program in 2010 and 2011. If you look on page 61 of your book, there's a table that breaks out the detail around this page. You can see those, the third line from the bottom there, you can see where those dollars are plugged in. You can also see them on page 60 listed as revenues. The federal stimulus for CCDF does have a non-supplementation clause. We have no federal guidance yet on what that means. Our assumption is that they will set a base year maintenance of effort, probably 2008, we're not sure. Because the forecast in current law for MFIP transition year is increasing so much, that is about a $25 million increase over 10 and 11. We believe we can use the stimulus dollars to help us mitigate that growth and to offset the general fund cost, which then allows us to help with the general fund deficit, not have to make additional reductions to this program. Obviously, if the federal guidance is different, we may have to reconsider what we're doing with this proposal. But these are costs that are driven by the worsening economy and the increase in the MFIP peso and thus the increase in the child care assistance for those families. We believe that's appropriate use of the stimulus dollars.
And Mr. Johnson, as I see you are using stimulus money now in terms of the governor's budget proposals, is that how the stimulus money is going to be intertwined into the budget proposals?
Madam Chair, in some cases yes and in some cases no. That is how we're proposing to use this chunk of the stimulus that is entwined in the budget proposals. As I went through TANF and some of the other pieces of my budget, you see we've entwined it in some of those as well. For the $3.4 million in quality set aside within the CCDF, it is not entwined in the budget proposals. We'll move that forward as a policy note, the statutorily appropriated fund. And as I mentioned before, Deb Swanson-Clack can describe here how we're looking at the process we'll use to determine how we will use those dollars.
So, Mr. Johnson, how do you suggest our committee line up our proposals with your proposals if we're going to be doing different amounts in different places, or does it matter if they line up?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if it matters. I believe, for example, if you wanted to appropriate the $3.4 million directly instead of having it be a statutory appropriation as we're proposing, I think you would just put that into your budget bill to directly appropriate for whatever the purposes are that the committee desires.
Okay. So, Mr. Johnson, so we're trying to figure this out so we can use stimulus money kind of where we need to as part of the budget package, it looks like, and that will all, in the end, be intermingled and come out with bills, is what it's looking like.
Mentor, that's my expectation as well. And the issue will be as long as we're paying attention to whatever the federal guidelines are, either around the particular stimulus or just the underlying guidelines around CCDF and what it can be used for and so forth.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe the biggest question first, and that is, When will we know fully whether or not stimulus money can be directly plugged into existing budgetary line items? Is that going to work with our budgeting deadlines here in the House? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I wish I knew the answer. We certainly expect that it should, but we don't. You know, we keep asking. I think that one issue with anything within the Department of Health and Human Services, there's no secretary, there's no leadership there right now, so I think that they're having difficulty coming to decisions on some of these pieces of guidance. But we're certainly hopeful that it will come soon enough so that we can make the right kind of decisions and not have to revisit these things in some kind of unhelpful later way.
Representative Downey?
Yes, Madam Chair. What is it in general that kind of dictates whether a stimulus allocation can be plugged into an existing budget item as compared to not? Are there some overriding factors or overriding program areas that are instructive for us as a committee, or is it just totally random and per item there's a different set of circumstances?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I think random might be a better description of it. It seems like within the different program areas that were in the stimulus bill, some had very extensive, clearly well thought out rules around how they wanted the money to be used. This CCF, I believe, is two sentences around what's supposed to happen with the money, and so we're left to interpret that until we get additional guidance from the federal agency.
Representative Downey and committee members, I mean, so that you know, we do have a stimulus bill coming to this committee for the 26.1, right?
million dollars. We are meeting with Mr. Johnson and his staff in the morning, the Early Childhood Caucuses, which is a bipartisan, bicameral group, to talk about how we are proposing to structure that money and how they are proposing to structure that money, and if there is any compromise on that. Otherwise, I think as the, you know, we'll be coming out with our bills, we'll probably, at least in our area, be adopting sort of what we're seeing here as it's being intertwined. So, but I think, I know Representative Greiling and her committee might be doing it differently. It is kind of open out there on how to do this. But we will be having a specific proposal we'll be hearing next week, and we'll be getting feedback. I think Representative Demmer maybe is going to be at that meeting, Senator Michelle. Mr. Johnson, do you want to have Ms. Hewitt come down and talk about the
Deb Swenson-Klatt.
I was just telling you, Swenson-Klatt and Hewitt, I always get those mixed up, which makes sound like a funny thing to get mixed up. So, she staffs the Early Childhood Advisory Council. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Deb Swenson-Klatt with the Department of Human Services Child Development Services Unit. And as Assistant Commissioner Johnson has said, I just want to briefly highlight what we are thinking about with respect to the $3.4 million that we understand is identified for child care quality improvements in the stimulus legislation. There should be a summary page available for you. You all have that in front of you. In this provides some information that Assistant Commissioner Johnson shared with you at a previous hearing. Again, with the dollar amount estimates, again, these are not confirmed by DHHS, but our estimates that we're working with $2.2 million identified for quality expansion targeted funds, and then another $1.25 million identified for infant-toddler quality support. This funding, of course, is one-time funding, and as we've mentioned in the past, it must be obligated by September 2010 and spent by September 2011. As we've been working to think through a planning process for these amounts, we're, of course, awaiting guidance on not only the use of funds, but if there are expectations about how we might read in discussion or planning for the stimulus funds into the planning process that's underway for the Child Care Development Fund plan for this next biennium. We would like to approach the use of the stimulus funds by, I think, first and foremost, supporting the efforts that we have underway to improve quality and, where possible, not reinvent the wheel, but build on and improve our existing efforts with these one-time dollars. With respect to the $3.4 million, we have had many stakeholders come to us at this point in the process, including yourselves, legislators, also members of the Early Childhood Advisory Council, which has requested an ad hoc committee to look at stimulus funds, advocates, and organizations, and it feels important to us to and we are absolutely ready to meet tomorrow morning with the caucus leadership and with other stakeholder groups to discuss the priorities that we're considering. At the bottom of the page are some of the priorities that we are looking at for the $3.4 million. They include efforts that would build on our existing work, and including our pilot parent aware quality rating system. So what we've been talking about internally is use of the funds for getting ready supports, as we've been referring to them, for early childhood programs to prepare for a possible statewide quality rating system. This would include, from our perspective, providers who are serving infants and toddlers. And so, from that perspective, we could not only use the targeted funds for quality expansion, but the targeted funds for infants and toddlers. Additionally, we would see great value in using stimulus funds for professional development initiatives aligned with the quality rating system, again, serving both providers who serve older children, preschool children, but also infants and toddlers. And finally, we're considering use of the stimulus funds for the FFN, Family, Friend, and Neighbor Caregiver Grant Program that the legislature passed in 2007. So that's a quick overview of what we're talking about internally, and we look forward to further discussion with you.
Something quiet. Are we going to see a bill from you on this?
As Assistant Commissioner Johnson referenced, I think with respect to these funds, we would not intertwine them with our existing invest in early learning proposal. These funds would be directed based on the planning process that I just described, and flow out through the department through the mechanisms that we typically identify for our base CCDF funding for quality.
So in this case, because the federal government is using federal formulas, and this is a formula, the CCDF, and the $3.4 million is part of that, the department's going to make their decisions on it without a bill, but just have the dollars flow through the department?
Correct, as we do with our current and base CCDF funds for quality membership.
And what happens when the legislature passes the exact same amount for a different purpose?
Well, I think as Assistant Commissioner Johnson just described, we will be in the coming weeks in the process of discussing our different proposals with you and moving forward from there.
So I guess, you know, we would appreciate the opportunity to collaborate as opposed to, you know, yours or ours, if it can be some kind of a mix. And I don't know. I mean, this is what's sort of the mystery, is if legislation would hold up if we passed it, and yet they're planning on it, you know, which version really becomes law or becomes trumps the other. I don't know if there. I mean, is that a
possibility? I'm not sure. I think that it's a state law decision that these funds are currently statutory appropriate, which means they flow through to us and we decide how to use them. So if you decide as a matter of state law you want to direct appropriate, then that becomes how the funds get used.
Okay.
I think you win that one if that's what you're
well, thank you. That's nice to know. Everybody hear that? Is that on the record? For today at 5:25, we won one, maybe. So that was just what we were hoping to hear. But I know that we've had a long road to go here, and depends on how they're interpreted. Members, do you have any other questions on either the 3.4 or the other part of it? Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, Assistant Commissioner Johnson or Ms. Clemson-Clett. It doesn't look like any of the money here is dedicated to scholarships or allowances. Am I right, I hope?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, that's correct. We've not allocated any money to those purposes.
Thank you very much.
I did have a question, too, about your proposal to do on the underspending on the Invest Early program. There, and I just, so the members are aware of this, there are other bodies in this legislature that might want to spend that money this biennium on other programs. Is there a possibility that might happen, or can they propose to spend that underspending this biennium? Or?
Madam Chair, yes, the funding could be used for other purposes this biennium, and they can, as we're proposing to do with a portion of it, be refinanced and then used, you know, for almost any purpose.
So, Mr. Johnson, if that happened and it was used for this biennium and not available, would you propose taking the money from somewhere else?
Madam Chair, we'd have to look at that as a possibility of using stimulus dollars or something else as a way to address our interest in extending those two pilots.
Thank you. As members know, there is a deficit going into this biennium that has some proposals, and one of them is to spend that money in a different way. So we just want to keep an eye on that and keep communicating about how much of that is left. Members, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And last, we have a presentation by Dr. Ephraim, if she wants to come forward. The schedule for next week, remember, this members, the schedule will be coming out. I know that on Thursday we have Representative Loeffler's bill, Representative Abler's bill, which we need to be passing both out of the committee, so we would need you here to vote, hopefully, so we can move those forward. We've been having technical difficulties, so I'm not sure.
Okay.
Our first presenter had to go without it.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, I will do my best.
Do you have handouts for us?
Or? I do. I have the handout that you have in your packet, which is the bigger thing for future reference, and then I have the PowerPoint slide on a handout. So if we need to work and have you look at it that way, that's what we will do. I'm going to just give this a quick try, and if it doesn't work, I'll go ahead.
It is something we're going to be looking at, because that's the second time, yeah. So you think during the legislative session we could get the PowerPoint to work, since we're almost done with session.
Okay. Well, technology is a two-edged sword.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I am a mother of three, trained as a pediatrician, and director of government relations for EdWatch. And I just want to publicly thank and commend Madam Chair for her willingness to hear what may be a different view from what you have been hearing for these many weeks.
You're welcome. And I just, to the members, we checked, I'll just say this, you know, a registered lobbyist, right? And so we wanted to give you the chance. We had Dr. Bruce Perry here and so forth, so give you the opportunity. So hopefully we've budgeted about 15 minutes or so, and if you'd like to move ahead.
All right. Well, as way of background and also as a way of responding to some of the testimony that I heard when I came in about the public vetting of early childhood programs and proposals, I wanted to let you know that this grew out of a presentation I did last year at the Humphrey Institute for a citizen jury who was asked to hear information about early childhood and decide whether it was a good idea for the state or not. And I presented for a half an hour, and the proponents presented for most of 3 days. And the jury was deadlocked. In addition, I would bring forth the situation in California in 2006. They had a ballot measure to raise taxes on the highest income earners to put forth a universal early childhood program that was in a liberal state in a very Democratic primary. With millions of dollars of support by proponents, and it failed by 20 percentage points. So I just want you to keep those things in mind. And also to remember that there are many overburdened, overtaxed families who believe that the raising and education of children is the job of parents. The first area I wanted to talk about was the brain research or neuroscience evidence.
I cannot go through all of the quotes, so I'm going to rocket through things very quickly, and the long quotes and references are in the other handout, in the one that came, that was in your packets. But there is much expert opinion that the current state of brain research does not show that early childhood education is necessary, and that it doesn't tell us what kinds of programs would be helpful and when to begin them. That first slide has a quote by Dr. Jack Schoenkopf, who is the author of the Neurons to Neighborhood Study, and Dr. Rolnick's favorite guru to quote, and even he admits that the neuroscience evidence is not that supportive. The next slide has a list of other experts from very prestigious universities, including Tufts, MIT, the University of Minnesota, and also the Minnesota Legislative Auditor, which say the same thing, and those quotes are in your handout. The major studies that are used by proponents say that early childhood programs are helpful are actually plagued and confounded by many issues, including methodological flaws, small numbers being very intense, atypical, and too expensive to be applied broadly. The biggest confounding variable is parental involvement. And those that have commented on some of these programs, like Chicago Parent Child Center and Perry Preschool, have found that it's difficult to figure out what element of the program works or whether it was just the intensive parental involvement that was required. Children in the Perry Preschool Project, although they did require having a parent in the home, they did do better in their outcomes than controls, but they didn't do very well compared to middle class children with regard to high school graduation, arrests, and welfare assistance. They were placed in remedial education more often than controls and unemployed at equal rates to controls at age 19. The Abecedarian Project cost $20,000 per child per year. It started at age 4 months and had a very small increase in IQ, most of which occurred in the first 2 months of a multi-year program. They had to combine IQ scores in a couple of the groups because some of them actually showed declines. The mother's IQ was a stronger predictor of the child's IQ performance than participation in the program. Proponents like Dr. Rolnick state that poverty is the biggest factor and that poor children will not develop properly unless the state is involved in these children's lives prenatally through age 5 via preschool programs. Yet, New Jersey had court-ordered preschool for poor children that was in a variety of settings, private through Head Start, and starting in 1998. By 2005, there were 40,000 children enrolled, yet the number of poor children scoring below basic, meaning illiterate, on the National Assessment for Educational Progress reading scores in fourth grade actually increased during that time. Dr. Rolnick also strongly believes in home visiting programs. Yes, 3 major national studies of home visiting programs showed no decrease in child abuse rates and no improvement or effect on child's cognitive, emotional, or behavioral issues. This could cost up to $47,000 per family, and this was in 1990s dollars. And raises major constitutional and data privacy concerns. So home visiting programs are not all they're cracked up to be either. The so-called kindergarten readiness assessments that I have passed out in previous committee meetings is quite subjective, and there are many concerns just with the instrument itself, talking about things like shows an appreciation for books and reading and other subjective items in the academic subjects, much less the arts and the social-emotional competence. I have just started going through research provided by the department regarding the validity of the work sampling system, and I haven't gone through it in detail, but I have yet to see the terms positive predictive value or reliability or those kinds of actual number statistics, so it seems a bit qualitative to me just on first glance. That research also says that we should trust the teachers. Yet, 2 years ago in this very committee, Tracy Wallace, who was one of the trainers for the kindergarten readiness assessment, said, we know that 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds are very poor test takers. You know, they have their own agendas, their own personalities, their own timelines, and they don't have the personal skills to sit for testing. And sometimes they lack language skills to truly explain what they know. They also haven't learned the social skills or social rules for test taking. So with any assessment of young children, we have to recognize the limitations of the data we have. She also said with work sampling and other kinds of observational assessments, you might wonder about the quality of the observation that the teacher did. And we might wonder about the conclusions that the teacher inferred from the observations. Are they accurate? And I think that's a very, very good question. In fact, there is no crisis in Minnesota. The Department of Education says that between 90% and 97% of Minnesota kindergartners are in process or proficient, which is quite contrary to the view that proponents put out that 50% of Minnesota kindergartners are not ready for kindergarten. The department also says that the purpose of this assessment is not to establish whether or not children are ready for kindergarten using a composite ready or not ready score, and that doing so can have unintended negative consequences, which is a very important thing to remember. There's also the issue of fade out with early childhood programs, meaning that the academic improvements, if there are any, don't last beyond second or third grade. I listed one study in the PowerPoint from 2006 at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and there are six other quotes from studies between 1985 and 2004 which show a remarkable consistency to that particular issue. In fact, I would submit that kindergarten readiness is not really the right criterion to be assessing, but actually long-term academic progress, things like closing the achievement gap or the NAEP scores in reading or math. Georgia and Oklahoma have actually seen declines in their fourth grade reading scores on the NAEP during the same period that there had been a huge expansion in spending and participation in preschool in those states. In fact, Oklahoma has the most kids enrolled in their universal preschool program of any state in the nation. Nationally, fourth grade reading, math, and science scores have remained flat over the last 40 years, despite a quadrupling of preschool participation during the same time. So if early childhood is really helping things, why haven't we seen an improvement in long-term academic achievement, at least in fourth grade when the effects of preschool would be the most obvious? In addition to academic harm, or at least ineffectiveness, there are references in your handout to 8 different studies involving thousands of children showing emotional and behavioral problems linked to child care and preschool participation. Proponents of early childhood programs also want to expand screening of those children, especially mental health screening. And as you can see from this quote on slide 17, describing the federal program, they want to screen all children beginning at birth and involve the families as well. EdWatch has a huge problem with that. They say that mental screening of young children is necessary because children are so undertreated for mental illness. Yet, there has been a 40-fold increase in the treatment of children between 1994 and 2003 for bipolar illness. The number of antipsychotic prescriptions, which is the strongest psychiatric medication that can be used,
for children doubled to $4.4 million between 2003 and 2006, with 20,000 prescriptions written for children ages 4 and younger. More money was spent on psychiatric drugs in 2003 for children than on antibiotics or asthma medication, and there was a 300% increase in psychotropic drug use in 2 to 4 year old children between 1991 and 1995. The psychiatric overtreatment of children is especially acute for poor children, children of color, and foster children, as shown in the graph on slide 19 about bipolar diagnosis increasing sharply among African American children. This is despite the fact that many expert groups and individuals admit that there is no consensus or ability to accurately screen and diagnose young children, and that the various treatments are ineffective and understudied. Another big area of concern to many parents and to EdWatch is the imposition of federal and state early childhood standards, especially ones that have absolutely nothing to do with closing the achievement gap. Here are some examples of these flagrantly non-academic outcomes from Head Start. That would be slide 21, dealing with empathy, gender and family composition, careers, and the environment. The next slide shows an absolutely almost identical set from the state of Minnesota, which sort of puts to rest the idea that these standards are developed on a state-by-state individual basis. The gender identity one is particularly concerning. It is defined in a major national curriculum called Making Room in the Circle as referring to a person's internal, deeply felt sense of being either male or female, something other, or in between. Other issues include environmentalism, multiculturalism, careers, and homosexuality. EdWatch believes that those issues are individual and should not be dealt with through state tax dollars and state-imposed standards, no matter what one's, what the family's personal beliefs are. Here's some eloquent testimony from a mother that testified in the Senate in 2006 on that very issue of parental authority and parental autonomy. She said, "My ECFE teacher modeled confusing non-traditional gender roles for my young sons. My four-year-old was told to pretend that he was mom. My two-year-old was encouraged to play dress-up in feminine clothing, including high heels. Without being alarmist, I believe this was intended intentional on behalf of the instructor. Our children were also taught to address the teachers by their first names. We sang songs about many different kinds of families, alluding to controversial social issues." She went on to say, "ECFE does not support, quote, parents as their children's primary educator, end quote, but treats parents as pupils. We are given homework. We are monitored during playtime. ECFE does not exist to learn from parents, but to impart knowledge, values, and attitudes to them, including how to parent. The concept of partnership between families and schools suggests the quality of influence that should not exist. The school is the resource to my family and subservient to it, not the other way around." And I think that is very important to remember as you are discussing these programs.
We have about 5 more minutes.
Yep. I'm actually on schedule, believe it or not. EdWatch believes that regardless of parent or family views, it is not the role of the state to be teaching these controversial non-academic subjects. Early childhood programs should not be setting goals and norms in these areas and undermining parental authority and autonomy. I quoted one of my favorite Supreme Court decisions, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, all the way back from 1925, which says that the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with a high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. The next slide contains three other Supreme Court decisions U.S. Supreme Court decisions that that say basically the same thing. I've talked about what doesn't work, but I would like to spend a minute on what actually does work. There are studies in your big handout about intact families and religious involvement actually erasing the achievement gap, not just improving it a little bit or having some temporary gains in academic performance. It erases it. Research also shows that actual parental involvement, not government parental involvement programs, improves academic performance, and direct instruction in academic basics such as phonics and traditional math works very well. Our recommendations based on that and reflected in the budget reduction recommendations that I brought a week or so ago are these. Early childhood programs should not be expanded, especially for middle and upper class children. Educational resources should be focused on academic basics and rigor in K-12. Government efforts to help at-risk children should only promote and support intact family formation and stability through welfare reform, not penalizing paternal involvement, or reforming divorce laws so that no-fault divorce should not be allowed when children are involved. Lowering the age and expanding the allowable uses and amounts for the education and earned income tax credit so that low-income single parents or parents that must work do so may do so at a program of their choosing. The kindergarten readiness assessment should not be used at all in Minnesota. Home visiting programs should not be funded or expanded in this state, and there's $16 million you can get rid of quite easily. Government should not mandate or set statewide early childhood outcomes or curriculum, nor require them of providers, especially private ones, through quality rating systems. Any academic guidelines should be completely voluntary, as well as only cognitive and physical in nature, not involving non-academic, subjective, vague, or politically controversial mental health, art, multiculturalism, or diversity training outcomes. Government should not be at all involved in early infant or early childhood mental health. So next to the last slide you have in your PowerPoint handout is from a particularly disturbing brochure that was put out by the Department of Children, Families, and Learning under Commissioner Jacks a few years ago. And it shows a picture of hands holding a baby's head with the phrase, "Their minds are in our hands." We want to remind you that the minds of our children are in the hands of their parents and not in the hands of state bureaucrats or programs. I thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Are there any questions, members? You know, I want to make an editorial comment, which is that, you know, I think we have to understand each other to move forward effectively. And if you look at, this is going to be way out there, but sort of Obama's reaching out across the world and so forth. But, you know, we have to find out what we have in common, you know, which is I think we do all care about kids. And I think that's kind of the bottom line to understand where to go. And I know it's often, you know, guerrilla warfare here at the legislature, but I think at least if we can start to understand where other people are coming from, it does help us be a better balanced legislature. Are there any questions at all? Okay. With that, thank you.
Thank you very much.
With that, we are adjourned.